through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
And welcome into Tom, Jake, and Stacy, a Monday edition for you. Bunch of great stuff coming up on the show today. We'll be speaking with Bob Condotta of the Seattle Times. We'll ask him about this Quentin Dunbar thing, as well as The Last Dance. Bob's been reporting on both. We'll talk to Mike Salk at 12:30. Welcome him back into the show after a week away. But we do need to start with the Quentin Dunbar thing, because we talked about that all through Friday's show. We had all kinds of developments, really, from Wednesday through Friday. And over the weekend, a couple of different things. Both Baker and Quentin Dunbar turned themselves in and were eventually released. But on the John Clayton show earlier today, Michael Grieco, who is Quentin Dunbar's lawyer, he was on. And we're going to play you a couple of cuts from him in just a second. But what I want to, I guess the main message that we want to get out to you guys today is that this story is not over, and it does need to play itself out through the legal process. We'll see how far that actually ends up getting. But as Stacy and Jake and I were talking about before the show, you know, from our position, I think we need to take a step back, because Stacy, I mean, at this point, it's he said, is it not?
No, definitely. I mean, it maybe is he said and then he said again, given that it sounds like the 5 signed affidavits that Dunbar's attorney, Michael Grieco, has are presumably from the same 5 people that were in that original police statement, right? That's our understanding. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it really is a situation of the Miramar police and their initial report versus Michael Grieco, his client, Quentin Dunbar, and then what Dunbar says, you know, people have to say about his involvement now.
And we've got questions about how the Seahawks will handle it. I mean, we've already heard how the Giants are looking at their guy, DeAndre Baker, telling him basically not to attend any kind of web activities for now. It sounds like the impression that I get is that he's in a little more hot water than Dunbar, at least from what's been said. But at this point, Same. It's about these witnesses saying he either was involved or he wasn't. And did they change their stories, or what's the disconnect there? We'll find out as this story plays itself out. But, you know, looking ahead a little bit in terms of what this means for the Seahawks, it's a waiting game. It's a waiting game. I mean, and I'm sure a lot of you guys out there, you've got your own opinions on whether or not you want him on the team at this point. I mean, I'm going to sit here and say I'm going to withhold judgment on that. Maybe you say he was in the wrong place. Even he admitted that, Jake, right? He put out that statement thanking the Seahawks for their support, but also saying that he had learned a lesson about keeping himself out of situations that could do him harm.
Right, and this is a situation, guys, that I think is going to be really interesting. One, as you'd mentioned, how it's going to play out legally through the legal process, and if Dunbar is acquitted of all charges and everything is dropped, it's really going to be something to see for Dunbar. Was this a tremendous wake-up call for him in terms of how he needs to conduct himself, who he needs to associate himself with? Because if this isn't a wake-up call, I don't know what is, because in a flash, you pretty much put your entire career, your life, in jeopardy, right? I mean, you know, you could talk about, you could take this in a lot of different angles, but for Quentin Dunbar, I think he better be counting his lucky stars that he is a part of an organization like the Seattle Seahawks, who, above all else, are going to go out of their way to support their players first and foremost. And obviously they're letting, you know, everything develop, and they're waiting and seeing what happens through the legal process. But they do everything they can to support their players until it's a situation where it is an obvious one where they have to pull back. And for Quentin Dunbar, I don't know if many other organizations would be trying to help him out through this whole process, be in communication with him to make sure that he's okay, that he's, you know, taking the right steps moving forward. Just like with the Giants, I think Baker's situation is much different because it sounds like he was the one that was, you know, carrying the weapon, pointing the weapon at the victims, and all of that. But still, I think the Seahawks have shown that they are going to go to great lengths to help a player like Dunbar in this case, because you never know where it's going to land, whether it's him, you know, being accused and then putting in jail, or if the charges are going to eventually be dropped.
My hope is that he comes up innocent of all charges, not just because, you know, we follow the Seahawks and we root for him to be part of the Seahawks. I'd rather just know that nothing terrible happened as opposed to something terrible happened. I mean, and to this point, it doesn't seem like anybody was hurt, but my God, could they have been? Yes, absolutely. So, all right, let's hear a little bit from Dunbar's attorney. This is Michael Grieco on with John Clayton just about an hour ago. Cut number one here, talking about what the witnesses are saying.
With these five individuals, you know, one of them had always consistently said that what the other four said was not accurate. So he gave the same statement to the police as the same statement he gave me. But the other four individuals, they've come around and they're telling the truth now, and they told it to myself that this didn't happen. And, you know, we're hoping that the state attorney's office down here does the right thing.
That's the he said part of it. And by the way, when we say he and he, we're talking about the same person or persons, right? Initially, the police say that these witnesses said Dunbar did wrong. Dunbar was part of this. And then all of a sudden, they give sworn affidavits to Dunbar's lawyer saying he didn't. I mean, where is the disconnect there? I mean, Grieco even says it. He says they've come around. What does that mean, they've come around? Like they had to be convinced that something that happened to them didn't happen? I just don't understand that part of it. And, I mean, we may never understand that part of it. I mean, did that strike you guys as weird? What do you think, Jake?
Yes. Yes, Tom. To me, that struck me very weird. there's only really two things that could have happened in this case. If you want to get crazy conspiracy theory, which I know, you know, you guys are all game for. If you want to get conspiracy theory, one thing leads you to believe that maybe, you know, Dunbar, after talking with them, working out some sort of a deal, some sort of a back channel of, hey, if you change your story, look, I'm on the verge of getting a massive payday, a massive contract. I could, you know, we can work out some sort of arrangement or two. And this is what I think is more likely, is the fact that done the day before and the day of. And if you're one of the victims, you're pointing them together. You're guilt by association, because Baker, you know, is the one that ends up pulling out the gun and is, you know, directing traffic in terms of, you know, hey, go take that, go steal this and that. To me, it's very easy for those victims to say, well, yeah, Dunbar was a part of it. He was a part of it, and therefore he's guilty by association. But if, you know, maybe they think back on it and say, well, you know what? Actually, Dunbar didn't do anything. Mm. He just sat there, right? And he wasn't really a part of what happened, right? And so maybe he was just as shocked as everybody else that Baker was pulling out a gun in that case. That's the only thing, Tom, that I can think of in this situation. How can those people be so adamant that saying that Dunbar was a part of this and then go back on it, you know, 24 hours later, not only going back on it, but signing affidavits for it? So those are the only two things I could come up with in this solution. So I don't know how hot or cold you guys think I am.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that – I think that that probably falls in line with most of the ideas that some people are bouncing around right now. I also can't really make sense of it. It's not like there hasn't ever been cases of police reports getting something wrong, but it also is just a weird situation in itself, considering you've got a lot of the same people involved saying both statements. So I don't really know what to make of it. I think what I'm more curious to see is what the NFL does, regardless of whether or not Dunbar is fully exonerated. If these signed affidavits are, you know, accepted, if witnesses come in and take back their claims and sign new statements, then, you know, who knows if that's a separate legal issue where the first time around you were lying or telling the truth. But either way, if they come in and there's nothing there for the police to press charges about, then there's nothing there, right? They can't do anything. But the NFL isn't completely adherent to that. They don't need charges filed. They don't need someone to be arrested. They don't need someone to actually spend time in prison for them to decide that actions violated.
Yeah, Jaron Reed last year.
Exactly. And I know we talked about this Friday a little bit, Tom, which you mentioned, with all of us saying, well, I don't really know if the NFL could get away with doing anything if police are given evidence and Michael Grieco proves that Dunbar was just kind of there. You're not guilty of anything if you just know someone that committed a crime. But the NFL might feel like they want to instill some punishment anyways. And that's completely within their right. And so I think what Seahawks fans are waiting for, and this is really kind of the story following this, is what is the NFL going to do even if Miramar police don't move forward pressing charges, right? Because that story isn't over. If these charges are dropped and Dunbar is legally exonerated, that doesn't mean the NFL can't do something. And that's the question that not only Giants fans with Baker, but Seahawks fans with Dunbar are going to be looking at too.
I hope if the charges are dropped and they find nothing, that the NFL doesn't do anything at all. I'm just going to say that right now. I mean, if they decide to punish him, what exactly Agreed. Are they punishing him for? Just hanging out with, you know, a couple of people. I mean, Goodell's going to have to be, well, you know what? I was going to say he'd have to be clear on that one, but you know what? He doesn't, because he is the judge, jury, and the executioner. He can do whatever the heck he wants. So I hope that nothing happens if the charges end up being dropped here. I mean that. All right, let's do a couple more cuts here. Michael Grieco again, Dunbar's attorney, talking about his connection to DeAndre Baker. Cut number two.
Completely untrue, at least as it applies to Mr. Dunbar. Mr. Dunbar was not with Mr. Baker at any point within the week or weeks prior. I think that there's been a complete mischaracterization as to the nature of their relationship, which is not as close as it's been portrayed, at least initially. And I can tell you that they've got their wires crossed with that one. I've already advised law enforcement that they're completely mistaken on that.
Mr. Dunbar, do you know Mr. Baker? Nope, never met him until tonight. I mean, that cut almost sounds like a little bit of – that sounds like spin to me. I mean, what the heck are you doing at the party then together? I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure if I believe that one. Cut number three. Grieco just prognosticating what he thinks is going to happen here.
I'm very confident that we're going to walk away from this. It may take days. It may take weeks. I hope it doesn't take months. But I'm very confident that Quentin will have his name cleared. It's not just about getting cases dropped. This is a case where an innocent man has been accused of a horrific crime that he did not do. I think that the police department rushed to judgment on this with no corroborating evidence other than the statements of four individuals, and they had a fifth individual who gave a contrasting statement. So I think that this is one where I wish they had put the toothpaste back in the tube sooner, but if I've got to be the one to do it, I'm going to be the one that does it.
And thank God for attorneys like Michael Grieco out there saving lives one at a time. Well, look, I hope that Dunbar ends up being innocent here too, because as I said before, that would mean that he didn't take part in a crime, which is great, and that would be great for the Seahawks going forward too. I think DeAndre Baker is going to be in a bit more trouble, and you know, the two teams, the way that they're treating both of these players, DeAndre Baker has been told not to attend any sort of web activities by the Giants. I don't know if that's just a difference in philosophy between the Seahawks and Giants, or if there's just more evidence that says Baker is guilty, and so the Giants are like, you know what, we're going to be hands-off with this guy. I don't know. But we'll definitely continue to observe what goes on as this case goes forward here. Right now, I got three questions.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we got to protect the kids" nonsense.
Guys, we've seen this with the Korean Baseball League. We've seen this now with NASCAR. Do you think that we'll ever reach a point where commentators will broadcast games from their homes? Like, as the normal standard practice? What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think we're going to see that as the normal standard practice. And I don't think broadcasters would want that to be the case either. They want to be there live and in the action to be able to feel the moment, to feel the crowd and the energy of the game and all of that. I think that, you know, and Brock Heward will tell you this, to do a broadcast like that from their homes, from remote, it's an extremely tough thing to do. And so you're asking these broadcasters to pull off a performance that's, you know, it's just tough. And you're not going to be able to get that same magic, that same feel as you would with them actually in person. So, Tom, maybe in the interim, as we're experiencing this quote-unquote new normal, you might see that to begin with. Maybe not in homes, but in remote, you know, stations and locations. But I can't imagine that the new normal, as we get past all of this, will result in that. I think it would be a very tough ask for these broadcasters.
Yeah, I could see it being something temporary. I don't know about with one specific sport over another, since in my understanding, a lot of these broadcast booths are typically a few people, right? You have someone who, depending on where you are, like they're an engineer operating the camera or the board for you, and then you've got, you know, the color commentator, the analyst, but like it's not like there are a ton of people in there. So could I see this happening as a precaution? Absolutely. I think the league is going to do whatever it takes, the NFL, to make sure that it starts in the fall at some point, whether it's delayed or not. The NFL is going to try to have a season. And if that means that going above and beyond to have the appearance of, you know, extra precaution and safety, then they'll do that. Do I think that a color commentator and an analyst could feasibly be in that room and just keep some distance and have precautions in that room and still do it? Yeah, I think you could still have those guys on site or gals on site for that event. So I could see it happening 1,000%. I really hope it doesn't.
Question two.
Number two.
All right. Most of us watched the final two parts 9 and 10 of The Last Dance last night, and they addressed the 1997 Game 5, the flu game, as it's been known
flu
for
game.
About 23 years now. But was it the flu game or was it the pizza game? Evidently, here's the story. Jordan and a couple of his friends, his trainer, I think his agent, were hanging out in a hotel or in Salt Lake, and they wanted to order a pizza. So they order the pizza, and a posse of five delivery drivers show up at their door with a pizza, which they found to be strange, as anybody would. And then Michael eats the whole by himself. And at 3 in the morning, he wakes up. He's throwing up, he feels terrible, etc. So was it the pizza game or the flu game, guys? What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, with the evidence, the circumstantial evidence that we have in front of us that has been laid before us, Tom, it is the pizza game. It's the food poisoning game. It's not the flu game. But, you know, here's the thing that shocks me in all of it. How does Michael Jordan just think that five pizza guys showing up is normal, or do you just say, look, they probably figured out it was me. You know, they all wanted to come and see me as they delivered the pizza. I don't know. I'd be very suspicious of that. I would not eat that pizza, especially when I'm in enemy territory the night before a big game.
I don't know. It's pretty hard to say no to pizza, though. Like, I'm not going to lie. I've eaten some very questionable.
The man was
like,
hungry.
$2, you know, cook it in the oven kind of pizza where you're like, is this sauce or ketchup? I don't know, but I'm going for it. No, I had the same question where I had been thinking for a while, because wasn't it a story prior to this that no, it was food poisoning, and then the debate was whether or not it was intentional or not, right? That was kind of what the debate became way before this documentary. But Yeah, I don't know. I don't think there was... I don't buy into the theory that it was something outside of that. Because you look at the way that he seemed to really take issue with how Dennis Rodman approached... was it the 97? What was the one where he went to Vegas with Hulk Hogan? He just seemed to have complete disdain
for... I think that was
98. Problems with work ethic. Yes, and even though this guy was like smoking cigars after games, I think he'd take issue with someone getting wasted before an important game or not trying before a game. So I don't buy the idea that he was like hungover or anything like that. I think it was food poisoning. I don't know how you get food poisoning from pizza, but I think that's what it is.
Well, how would the delivery guys have known where that the pizza was going to Michael Jordan? I mean,
intel.
Unless they put Michael Jordan's name on it, which would have been stupid. They would never do that.
The thing is,
so if
though,
I put Joe Schmo on the order.
But sometimes you can find out all kinds of information. It's not just reporters that know. It's, you know, a doorman knows that someone's staying there. Someone that drove the bus knows they're staying there. A person who sold, you know, coordinated the team to get on the bus. Like, it's all kinds of people know this information.
Yeah, but the pizza guys would have to do a lot of research in the span of, what, 20 minutes from the time the thing is ordered
maybe it was,
until whenever.
Maybe it was accidental food poisoning.
This is the look. If you're going to try and help the Utah Jazz win, you're going to do anything it takes, Tom. You're going to figure it out. You're going to put this web of detective work, some backdoor channeling. You're going to make it happen. And they did.
Jake,
they took their best shot at Michael. They took their best shot. They couldn't take him down.
They didn't have the means. They had the motive, but not the means. Question three.
You don't know that.
Number three.
Pretty resourceful.
Unless I missed something, this was a 10-parter. I watched everything. But unless I just missed something, why no mention of Michael Jordan's wife or the Wizards, his time with the Wizards? Those are kind of two separate questions because he went back to play for the Wizards a couple of years later. Maybe they just didn't want that to be part of it. They saw it as superfluous. I don't know. But do you think it was weird that his wife wasn't in the documentary and they didn't mention her?
Yeah, I think it was strange to some degree. I mean, hey, he did mention her when he was talking about his gambling issues. Hey, he didn't have gambling issues or his wife would go hungry, you know? I mean, she made it on there. But I hear what you're saying in terms of, you know, being part of the conversation. I think it would have put into great context in terms of Michael Jordan's home life. What was it like, you know, in terms of Michael Jordan? Was he around? Was he present? Or was he just solely focused on being one of the best, right? I think that those are some things that I would have been interested to hear about. But I think it was more just centered and geared towards what was happening at that facility and on the court. You know, they kept it very, very specific.
Given the amount of control that Jordan had over the release of footage in this documentary, I could see him saying, look, there are a couple things that are off limits to me, and one of them is my family. And maybe another one of them was
That's
his
a great
stint
point
with
too.
Washington or the later part of his career. But I didn't mind. I would have liked some insight into his family life because it is always fascinating to see the different facets to someone, particularly with not just professional athletes, but people in kind of high stakes jobs. The way that they can compartmentalize, like they're this person with their family and this person off the field, is fascinating to me. I'm okay with the fact that we didn't see that because I assumed it was a decision by Michael Jordan, and that's his right and his privacy to keep his family private. But with the Washington stuff, who knows if that was him or not, but I was okay with that not being part of it. I liked the idea of it ending with the win in 98 and just ending with this idea of this was the team. We followed this team through this this two-time three-peat, and we saw this. And it almost, it rather than end with the question of we're tracking Michael Jordan's career, I like that it ended with a kind of question of could they have won a seventh? I'm thinking then about the team, about this iteration of the Bulls, and not necessarily just Michael Jordan, although Michael Jordan obviously was the big part of that documentary. I didn't mind it focusing just on that time.
We'll be talking more about this ourselves coming up in about 20 minutes. But up next, did the documentary change Mike Salk's opinion of Michael Jordan? We'll ask him. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
And it's great to have our friend Mike Salk back in the 1230 chair with us. Mikey, how you doing?
I missed you guys. It's good to be back with you, although it sounds like I was probably Wally Pipped by the Groz as usual.
Yeah, Salk,
I
heard that you just wanted to get back on because you heard how great Groz was doing, how much of a great time we were having with the Groz.
I'm not surprised. Nothing is better time. No, there's no better time spent than time spent with the Groz. So I'm just happy to have a little spot back to be able to talk to you guys every day.
No doubt about it. I saw a tweet from you, Mike, saying how special or unique you thought The Last Dance was as a documentary, because for whatever reason, you don't normally get into sports documentaries. What was so special about this one?
I've been trying to figure that out, and Brock and I will probably spend some time on that this week as well. But look, first of all, I just have more time, right? I mean, there's so much good stuff on television, and you know, when you're at work and you've got kids and there's a million sporting events going on and everything else you want to watch, you just sometimes don't have time for every 30 for 30 and everything else. So, you know, we just all have time for this. So that's probably what got me hooked on it to begin with. But I don't mind at all that it's not a perfect documentary. I don't mind at all that it only tells Jordan's side. I just find it compelling. I thought the music was good. The interviews were great. I like that ESPN left an unfiltered version. I thought seeing Jordan's reaction to everything and showing him the iPad of other people's videos was really compelling. And while I watched him and generally rooted against him when he was a player, getting a chance to just see what a stone cold killer he was behind the scenes and you know, my favorite moment was at the end of the episode 7, so not the ones that aired last night, but the first one that aired last week, where he's asked about his teammates and whether or not they would like him or think he was, you know, fun to be around. And he gets kind of choked up, right? And he says, look, winning has a price. Leadership has a price. And I'm so fascinated by him walking that incredibly fine line between doing anything that is necessary to win and sacrificing being liked and being at times even a good person to be around. Most of us don't have the ability to do that.
It is pretty incredible, Salk, when you point that out, because like you said, a lot of us, we all want to be well-liked and we all don't want to put ourselves out there like that for multiple reasons. And Jordan was more than willing to do that. And the reason why was because he saw no other way for him to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. He had to get it done, and there was no other option for him than for his teammates and everybody around him to hold him to that standard.
I wanted to relate it to your sport. Jake, I wanted to ask you about it because he's able to do that. Basketball is a team sport, but it's also an individual sport. It's almost like baseball, right? Basketball is a team sport because it takes five guys at one time. But let's face it, one guy can influence a basketball game more than any other sport other than a starting pitcher, maybe a hockey goalie. So Jordan could be that kind of a jerk to his teammates. He could be that style of leader. Can you do that as a quarterback of a football team?
You have to, Salk, it's interesting that you asked that because it's a very interesting place to be as a quarterback. There are very few guys that can do it, and I think it doesn't come from just being there right out of the gate. You can be that. You have to, one, be established like Michael was and things of that nature. But because the quarterback position is inherently kind of a leadership position, you also have a bunch of guys on the team that look at that position as, hey, he's part of the company line, right? And so there is something that works against you at the same time at the highest level when you are the quarterback, where everybody will listen to you and you're the guy that has to hold a certain standard and should be that guy. But you have to have, I would say, for a really good team, you have to have probably three or four leaders that are all on the same page on a football team. Numbers amongst a locker locker room, and also it's just way more diverse. And so if you have four guys on your team that are pretty much in lockstep with the right idea and the right conversation, and you have your quarterback as one of those guys, then you have a unique environment. Whereas Jordan, I mean, he really was able to set the tone all by himself. And Salk, I'm curious to you know, ask you this and get your thoughts on this is – you know, you mentioned your favorite moment. Was there another moment in your mind where it just changed your perception of Michael from being a guy that you just couldn't stand him to, wow, I actually really appreciate this guy?
I don't know that I still don't like him, right? I mean, I watched it. I can't tell you I came away liking him in the running form. I mean, he's not a particularly likable character. He's not particularly sympathetic. But I guess I just admire that. All those times I kept hoping that this would be the time he would fail. This would be the time the Knicks would beat him, or the Lakers would beat him, or the Jazz would beat him, or the Sonics would beat him, or whoever it was, the Suns. I certainly was rooting for the Suns in that series. Every time it didn't matter. He just found a way to use whatever it was he could find as fodder. Karl Malone winning the MVP. Somebody saying something nice about Dan Majerle. It just didn't matter. Seeing that behind the scenes and the way he used all that stuff to his advantage, I thought was enlightening. And, you know, I found myself thinking a lot about Brady and Belichick and about Pete and Russ as I was watching it. And when I hear you, Jake, talk about, you know, quarterbacks being viewed as management, I can't help but think about Belichick kind of in some ways playing the Jerry Krause role. No, obviously he's not thought of in history quite like Jerry Krause. But hey, if they're all mad at me and I'm the kind of the big jerk at the top, well, then they can't be mad at the quarterback for being the style of leader that Tom Brady is. And then I found myself thinking about Russ and some of the complaints that Richard and Doug had of Russ not being held accountable the right way. And, you know, I disagree with them in general. I think Russ was certainly able to flourish this year without Doug holding him accountable all the time. But I sort of understand some of their point of, If the quarterback is management and tends to be viewed that way, maybe it helps for a coach to hold the quarterback even more accountable in order to sort of show that separation.
We're going to get into our conversation about The Last Dance next. So while we still have you, I want to ask you about Quentin Dunbar. You were gone from our airwaves this week, and we didn't even get a chance to talk to you about it. So what was it like seeing all that news at once? How did you find out the news? Just can you walk us through your own processing of that?
It made me very happy to not be doing a daily talk show and not have to react instantly because this is one of those situations where news comes out. You're on the radio, you got to comment because this is what's happening, but we don't know the whole story yet. And so you end up saying things that, you know, you may or may not regret later. And I've certainly done it 100 times myself. Look, I think that reading this is he certainly put himself in a bad situation. It certainly seems fishy, right? People give one story, then they recant with a completely different story. None of it looks good for him, whether he did it or not. None of it looks good for the Seahawks and John Schneider, who just brought him in, whether he truly, you know, committed the act that he's accused of or not. It's just not a good look for anybody. I don't, you know, like most of these situations, they matter more in the off season. And once we get into the regular season playoffs, if he plays well, generally these things get forgotten because at the end of the day, we're here to watch football, not to make a morality conversation about whether or not you should steal money from people. But it's a bad look right now. And he's sort of been held up as the best thing the Seahawks have done so far this offseason. Now all of a sudden there's a big black mark on asterisk on that. And so, you know, it continues this sort of, in my view anyway, an offseason where they're not putting their best foot forward. And in this case, the foot we thought was best might not be as good as we thought it was.
Great stuff, Mikey. Thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
All right. Miss you guys. See ya.
Likewise. You know, I think that there's one major difference between LeBron James and Michael Jordan that the LeBron James people aren't willing to acknowledge. We'll talk about it next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
It was interesting. Last segment, I thought Mike Salk put it aptly in describing Michael Jordan as a stone cold killer, which is exactly what he was. On the court, off the court, he found, somehow, he found that motivation wherever he needed to go out there and just make darn sure that it was his team that was coming up on the winning side every single time. And I mentioned before the break, in this LeBron versus Jordan debate, I don't know, I can't prove this. It's just something that I sense. Right, but from the things that LeBron says, does, his results on the court, the pro-LeBron people like to look at LeBron's athleticism and what he does physically on the court. And I think that they've got a point. I think physically, LeBron, it might be a better basketball player. But one thing that LeBron has not really shown himself to be consistently is a stone-cold killer. I think he's way too nice and genial a guy to really assume that role. I mean, he's gone out there. He's got a couple of championships to his credit. But he doesn't have that same quality that Michael Jordan does. Or at least he doesn't have it to that same extent. What do you think about that, Jake?
Well, I would agree with that to a certain degree. I mean, a lot of the criticism that LeBron has had throughout his career is the fact that he has not been that clutch finisher at the end of games, the guy that is constantly wanting to take the last shot, those types of things. And I think those are overplayed because most of the time LeBron James is passing the ball when he should, pass it to an open player, and it's up to that player whether he executes it or not. You've seen, different points, Michael Jordan, passing it off to teammates and them coming up and hitting the big shot, right? So I think it goes back and forth on that. And for LeBron, Kobe had that mentality of Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, they wanted the ball. They wanted to shoot the ball at the end of the game, no matter what. Unless it was a situation where somebody was either wide open or they couldn't take the shot themselves, they wanted it. And LeBron has routinely passed up that opportunity throughout his career. So I understand that killer mentality, but I also think that there's something, when people knock LeBron versus Jordan, that LeBron has gone off to different teams, whereas Michael Jordan was able to have all of his success with one team, and that was the Chicago Bulls for a number of years. So I think that those kind of things all factor in. But I do think that it's clear for me to take this position that I do think Michael Jordan is the greatest of all time, and LeBron James is clearly number two, and it is a close two, in my opinion. I think Michael is number one, but I can't sit here and say that, LeBron hasn't accomplished, a whole lot in his career. You just look at his numbers, and he's been able to do some pretty spectacular things.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for just coming first, right? That an older generation, especially, though a healthy portion of a younger generation, will always appreciate Michael Jordan for that and see him as, like, the original GOAT. But I think there's another thing to be said for actually winning championships and winning those finals. And that is something that Jordan's always going to have. And so, at the end of the day, when you get down to it and you're looking at who's accomplished more, I think it's one of the easiest things to point to. And not just won them, but like you were the MVP. You were, with the exception of what? 1 year?
No, I think he got him every year.
Every single time, or MVP of that.
Are you talking in the finals or for the season?
Every time.
In the finals. Finals MVP, he was every time, but I was thinking the season. But
right.
But yeah, you dominated the years in which you won. It wasn't just like you were part of a team that won. You were the face of the team, and you were the spirit of the team. You were everything. And so it is hard not to also directly attribute those six championships to Michael Jordan directly. So that is always something that you're going to be able to cite in that argument. I think that I go back to early in the episode. Who was it that was being interviewed when he said, "I hate it when people ask," was it LeBron? No, someone being interviewed saying, "I hate it when people ask to compare players. Like, why not just appreciate a player's greatness?" And I bet that that's how those players feel. I'm sure that's how maybe Kobe felt is, look, I want to be me. I'm one of one. And whether or not I'm better than this person, cool. I think I could take them on. But like the definitive ranking maybe gets irksome after a while. But I don't know. I think it reinvigorated the conversation. I think especially for younger fans, it might have swayed a couple of them to the kind of Jordan side of that spectrum. But I don't know. I mean, there are areas where LeBron has excelled a little bit more. So it's I don't like the direct comparison. I hate it.
You hate the direct comparison. You know, I'll admit, this is one of the first times.
I don't like the definitive ranking kind of thing.
Well, there isn't one. I mean, you have to acknowledge that. There's no way you can quantify the word best. You just can't do it. I'll give you one more argument for Jordan's side. And it's something that didn't really occur to me until watching this documentary, and I should have been able to spot it. But, I mean, my God, the competition just in the Eastern Conference that Michael Jordan had to get through to get to the finals, whether it was the Pacers, the Heat, the Knicks, the Magic, whoever it was, LeBron James never had any of that competition and still didn't make it out of the Eastern Conference most of the time. So, I mean, that comparison right there, Jordan's got him just crushed. I mean, there isn't really even a comparison to be made there with the Eastern Conference the way it was in the 90s compared to what LeBron has had to get through as a member of the Cavaliers or the Miami Heat. I mean, there really is no comparison at all there. But, yeah,
There's one other thing that, Tom, there's one other thing that stood out to me when you talk about this conversation about, you know, LeBron, Jordan, and where they all stand out and everything. To me, it's also about the NBA and the state of the game and the rules that were in place at that time. You talk about the competition, but talk about the physicality as well of the game of what it was in Michael Jordan's era. To me, the physicality and the nature in which that game was played, and it's also part of the thing that, like, that's I grew up watching the NBA being that way, and so I'm very reminiscent of the game being physical and being tough and being cut from that cloth, and the fact that there was no load management, that wasn't even a question. It's not that it wouldn't have been smart, but none of those players wanted any part of it. They wanted to go out every single night and lay it all out there. And I think that part of it, to me, is something that I greatly miss from this game. Currently, as I watch the NBA, and you watch, you know, just how, you know, the flops and, you know, the way the game is officiated now. To me, I mean, it was way harder to play in the NBA during the era of Jordan than it was for LeBron James during this time. That's another thing that, as I watched that documentary, it just really reminded me of, yeah, the NBA used to be physical. It used to be a hard-nosed type of game.
You know what's so interesting is I'm seeing kind of the opposite opinion on our text line a little bit. I'm just kind of glancing at it. 710-710, Vizzy, Hard Seltzer text line if you want to join. I feel like one of the things I'm seeing most on here is that LeBron has tougher guys to play. Maybe not with the style, like the physical style of play, but athleticism, what guys are capable of. I feel like what I'm seeing on the text line. I don't agree with it, but I think that
if that's your argument,
LeBron somehow has a harder road.
If that's your argument, then you have to be able to prove it somehow. You can't just say,
you got to say who you're talking about.
Yes, well, I mean, and I know when you text in, there's only so much room. But, like, if you say that the players today that LeBron's going up against are better athletes than they were in the 90s, you need to be able to describe how so. I mean, you telling me that all those teams we just mentioned, you know, Alonzo Mourning and Patrick Ewing and all those guys weren't physically dominant. I'm not sure I understand.
No, I think that people just generally think that today athletes are somehow more elite, whether it's better training, sports medicine, just the ways that our bodies have changed, adapted. I think that I see this conversation with football all the time. I don't think it applies as directly to basketball. I think you look at some of the guys that Jordan was playing in his heyday, and a lot of these guys are like Hall of Famers. So I don't know what you're talking about, but I understand why people make this argument, because they look at, say, football, and they say, like, you know, football players maybe weren't as fast and as elite as they are today, but I don't know. I don't know.
That's
that you
probably
could
true.
That across.
No, in the NFL, I mean, today's wide receiver can make all kinds of circus catches that you never saw in the 90s. I mean, Odell Beckham makes that one he's famous for. There's like 10 guys in the league who can make that same catch.
Well, I look at like the
now.
Evolution
and
of
the way these guys get their feet down. Yeah, I just think the NBA, those guys are closer now to what they were in the 90s. I don't see as much of a division. We'll get Bob Condotta on from the Seattle Times next. Talk about The Last Dance and the latest on Quentin Dunbar. 710 ESPN Seattle.